History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And the reality is, they don't have to go untold. If we'll just take the initiative to ask a few questions of some of our neighbors who have lived a little longer than we have. And perhaps what's more important is that we patiently listen to what some of the answers to those questions might be. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we always come out ahead because not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we really end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. The story we're going to hear today in San Diego, California, is a story of great heartbreak, a story of loss, but also a story of perseverance, of hope, and of always finding a way to put others before yourself. That's what Betty Rosevere has been doing for nearly a century. Betty was one of the more than 300,000 women who served in U.S. Armed Forces during World War II. She did so in the Army Nurse Corps, but before that, she experienced something that none of us would ever choose to experience. She became a Gold Star widow. Her husband, Billy Huffman, was one of the more than 406,000 Americans who died while serving in World War II. We're going to learn a little bit about him and a lot about Betty over the next hour. I just wanted you to have that little overview, but we'll start with the first impression most people have when they meet Betty. We've all heard it said that it's not polite to ask a woman her age, but the answer Betty gives to that question doesn't seem to fit with the active lifestyle she maintains in San Diego, where she serves as companion and caregiver for a World War II Navy veteran named Vic Walters, from whom we'll hear in a future episode. It really doesn't quite seem possible that Betty Rosevere was born in June of 1921. 99 years old?
Right.
Is that the truth?
Yep.
How often do you get asked that, Betty?
I don't tell anybody anymore because they think I'm something's wrong with me.
They don't believe you.
They think I have good eyesight and I'm doing about everything myself and they don't believe me.
What do they say at the DMV?
Well, I still have a driver's license because if you can see well and you can pass all of the stuff with the, and I use a computer, I still do that. And so I answered all the questions correctly, and my daughter was there with waiting for me, you know. And I said, well, I passed. I think I can drive until 2024, I think.
So that's the year you'll turn 103.
My kids won't let me drive much anymore.
Well, let's just ask this question now. I won't build the suspense for the whole time. What's your secret to having such good eyesight, to being so mentally sharp and in such great shape at 99 and a half years old?
I think my parents helped. I think my parents were great. All those children, and yet we had a wonderful life. I really did.
And you say all those children.
Ten. Yep. 10 children, yes.
And where do you fit into that?
I think I'm about the seventh.
The seventh of 10.
Mm-hmm.
Born north of the border in Alberta.
Yes.
On a cattle farm?
Yes.
And how old were you when you moved to the States?
I was probably about three, I'm not sure. I don't remember anything about it. My grandfather came from Nebraska,
uh-huh.
And he had a big touring car. So we got all in that. They had some boards on the side, and he drove us down from Canada, and he left that car with my dad. My dad said it was so big that he could never get rid of it. And then they wanted to tax him here for it, so he drove it back to Canada and sold it there.
So tell us where you grew up.
In the state of Washington, just a little north of Portland, Oregon. And I went to nurses training in Oregon, Baker, Oregon. And so, I was there several years. That's where I met my first husband. He was in college then, and I was a student nurse. And I met him at a dance.
Well, I want to hear about that. When you're the seventh of 10 children, that has to be an entertaining existence.
Yes.
I imagine that means all the kids have to do something to contribute to the family, to the farm, to the household. What do you remember about that childhood in the 1920s? What were some of the things that you had to do?
I churned the butter every Saturday. It was a big wooden thing that you put the, my mother put all the milk in it, and or probably she saved the some of the heavy milk for it. And then I would, I was the only one that had the patience to sit there and pump it up and down. But actually, we didn't have many tasks on the farm, really. My dad worked in town. My mother was very efficient, but everything was pretty well organized. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have to do too much. But we rode the bus to school because we lived out of the city, town, about 8 miles. But we had a wonderful life on the farm. We used to go walk around, take people up. We had a lot of relatives that came to visit from from Nebraska and different places. And we would take them up in the hills. And we had a little stream that ran through the farm. And we used to go down and take something out of the garden. My dad had a nice, great big vegetable garden. And we could stick carrots or something in the water and wash them off and eat them.
So how'd you get along with those 9 siblings?
Well, actually, we really did pretty well. But I had, most of mine were sisters, so my brothers were all older. So that was like a big separation. But my sisters were pals, like used to go for walks together and do things together, you know. And they were really good at, we never got many presents for Christmas, except underwear and stockings. Then when I was about 13, my dad wheeled out of the bedroom a girl's bicycle.
Ooh.
So my younger sister, or some of my sisters and I, were always out on the bicycle going up and down this gravel road, pumping away.
Taking turns.
Yeah, taking turns, yeah.
I have 2 teenage daughters, and they love each other. But if it's up to whose turn is it, sometimes there's a disagreement about whose turn it is. So when you have 7 girls taking turns on one bicycle...
No, they didn't. My older ones didn't bother. It was the younger ones.
So it was only 3 or 4 girls taking turns on one bicycle?
Yeah.
Yet you all lived to tell the story.
Yeah.
And I imagine life was different for a young girl then than it is in 2021.
Oh, boy, yes. Yeah. Well, in some ways it wasn't. You know, we used to do each other's hair and things like that. But I never had long hair because my mother was great at cutting hair. If you have all those girls, you don't have long hair.
She had to manage it, huh?
Yeah, right.
I have to ask, because the people that lived through this time, everyone experienced it differently, and some have vivid memories, some don't. But those depression years, did you see that weigh on your parents? Did you see your family dealing with that economic hardship in a way that helped you get through it?
I don't think as we did as much as other people. Somehow or other, my mother and father were very good at taking care of things. My mother would even save money. We always felt fairly good about how things were at that time. When we talk about it, when I talk about it with my sisters, I only have one left now. But we always talked about the good things, you know, that happened that were really good. We were really lucky that we didn't have all of the problems that other people had.
Mm-hmm.
People who didn't have the land. My dad had 45 acres, so that meant you had all firewood you needed, you know, things like that.
And I bring up the difference between young ladies now and then, because today, if you're a girl going to school, there's nothing that's off the table, right? There's any kind of job, any kind of career that is an option for you. When you were a young lady, that wasn't necessarily the case. Did you have an idea growing up of, here's something that I am going to be able to do with my life, that I want to do with my life?
No, I think it was harder then.
Yeah?
You know, yeah, to get some kind of job. I was lucky. One of my sisters lived in Eastern Oregon, and she wanted me to come and visit her. So I went there, and she said to me, why don't you go to the hospital here? They're taking in student nurses.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 2 weeks, I was a student nurse after I finished high school. So somehow or other, I don't know. I think I had it easier than some people did. It turned out really well for me because I liked it.
Well, but you would deal with some hardships as well that we're going to hear about. What was it about nursing that was a draw for you? What appealed to you about that career?
Well, I always liked doing things for people. I take care of Vic, you know.
Yeah.
And I took care of my husband when he was ill for few years. And I always kind of liked doing that, so it was easy for me.
So
this is all before World War II still, at least before America's in the war.
Right.
So you go to nursing school there in Baker City, you said, Eastern Oregon.
Yes, right.
Become a nurse. When did you meet Billy?
Well, he was in college at the State College. His father lived on a farm. His mother died when he was born. And he had a very, very nice stepmother. And he was the only child, though, which was a terrible tragedy for him, for his father. I went to a dance with some of the nurses would go to this place where they used to have the bands that came and played in a hall someplace.
Sure.
We went off there. And I met him there.
And was this before Pearl Harbor still?
Yes. Oh, yes. He was still in college then, about the last year as a student nurse. And I went to take my boards in Oregon, and I worked at a children's hospital when they had a polio pandemic. It was really bad. Then he went to Texas for training to be a pilot. So then he called me up. I'd known him then probably off and on about 2 years because he went back to school, and then I was still in Baker, Oregon, and I finished there. Then I was in Portland when he called me and asked me if I would marry him, and I said yes.
So he proposed over the phone?
Yes, yeah. Uh-huh. Well, we kind of knew that anyhow by that time, yeah. But he was kind of shy, and so was I. Maybe it was easier for him on the phone, you know?
Maybe.
And people were different in those days, you know. He came to Portland, and we got married in Portland, Oregon. And then we were together off and on for a while. And then he moved to a field in Walla Walla, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And then we were together there for a while, for about a few weeks. And then eventually he went to South Dakota, Rapid City, I think it's called. And I went there, flew there to see him, and then he went to England. So that was the last time I saw him.
You met him. He's a college student. He becomes a pilot. You guys are married. But then America's at war.
Yes.
And he's being sent overseas.
Yes. Well, one thing about him was that his mother died when he was born, maybe 2 weeks after he was born. And she called him Billy Lou. And when, after the war, you know, after all this happened, I got in touch with the 452nd group. First thing they asked me was he from the South?
Because of Billy Lou?
He didn't look like a Billy Lou. So they said, well, then he named his airplane Mavourneen. And that's a song that I used to sing to him. He loved that song. I don't know. It's not really anything special, but it's what the nuns used to sing together. So they taught it to me because I kind of liked it. It's Come Back to Erin, Mavourneen, Mavourneen. I can't sing anymore. Come back, Aroon, for the land of your birth. And so he loved that song. That's the first thing. Those two things they asked me. Was he from the South? And why did he name his ship Mavourneen?
And that's why.
Yeah. And my daughter then, by that time, I didn't talk to him about him for years. And my daughter said to me, could we find out some more about him? And so I said, okay. So she's the one who went on the computer and found all kinds of stuff. And then they sent me every month I can't see that.
The Bomb Group newsletter?
Yeah. They had a group, you know, that they got together. And they wanted me to come, but I don't remember someplace else. And I was always busy. I lived in a lot of different countries, as you can see by all the things.
Yeah.
Yeah. The sad thing, I think the hardest part for me was his father. First he lost his wife, and then Billy was only about 22 or 3 or something like that. And then he loses his only son.
Yeah.
And he didn't last very long after that. He died. What we talk about, a broken heart, he had that, you know. And it was really terrible. Yeah. It was terrible for me, but I think his father was the one I sympathized with the most. It was just as if he took his whole life away.
And I know, even though it's been this long, this is something that can still trigger a lot of powerful emotions, and I want to be sensitive to that.
Yeah.
But what can you tell me about Billy? What kind of guy was he? What was it that made you love him the way you did?
Well, he was just very kind and sort of shy. He loved taking pictures, took so many pictures of me. He was very good at doing a lot of things. He loved being with people. He was always happy, but he wasn't very talkative. When we used to go out for dinner with somebody when we were in Walla Walla, we just had a room in a house, so we always went out with several people from his group. And we always had such a good time. He was just a really nice, quiet, sweet person. Yeah. I'm lucky, you know, that my second husband was like that, too.
So you met some of his crew before they shipped out?
Yes, I did, but I don't remember. I remember one because there's a guy who comes on TV, looks just like him, with the same last name, Mattingly. And I keep wondering, I wonder if he is a relative of Howard Mattingly. He was a navigator on another plane, and they were good friends. So we got together, and he was married, too. Mm. And he had a really nice young wife, and we always had such good times together. This was in Walla Walla, Washington. His plane disappeared. I heard later on, I read some things about different planes that they had found. They found some of the people on his plane. It went down in someplace in Europe in the water, and they never found him. But I used to write to his wife. She remarried like I did. She had four children. I had three, and we used to go back and forth about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a bad time. We had wonderful times together, though. It wasn't too upsetting until until he left, and then I knew then. When I went to South Dakota, I knew that was the last time I would see him. I only saw him for the weekend, and then he was gone again.
Are you suggesting that you had a premonition or an inkling that something would happen to him?
No, I didn't. I wrote to him every single day. I wrote to him, and he wrote to me as much as he could. No, I never. He was always so self-assured, you know. He was a good pilot. He was very friendly, but it was probably too good what he did. He was in the front of the Big Week. Do you remember?
Leading the formation?
Yeah. Did you ever read anything about Big Week, the 2 weeks when they were, that was February 20th and on, the 2 weeks then, when they put up all those planes?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was one of the leading planes.
The B-17, flown by Betty's husband, Billy Lou Huffman, had taken off from Depham Green, home to the 452nd Bomb Group in England. The target was in Poland, but that required flying across Germany. The bomber was attacked by German fighter planes, and rockets from those Junkers Ju-88s struck the American aircraft, which would eventually come down near Korsør, Denmark. You can find photos and related information at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And when we come back, we'll hear from Betty about what happened, about how she found out, and the decision she made to join the armed forces herself after her husband had been killed in action. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.